This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, April 26, 2006, and this is the KABU Morning News. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up on this morning's program, the European Parliament says that the CIA clearly violated an international treaty with undeclared flights over Europe. And the House is taking up a bill that will give billions of dollars to the new Intelligence Director's Office, but the top dollar amount and even the number of pages is classified. And a new study shows that 41% of the people with moderate middle incomes didn't have any health care for part of last year, up from 2001. And today's weather calls for clouds with temperatures in the mid-60s.
The Portland City Council will vote on a resolution today to set aside funds that will provide needed low-income housing in the city. Portland City Commissioners Eric Sten and Sam Adams will introduce the measure funding development, preservation, and rehabilitation of affordable housing. It's expected to pass unanimously. Housing activists are praising the move. The group Affordable Housing Now says creating an urban renewal set aside has been one of their long-time key goals. Sam Chase of the Community Development Network said the set-aside funds will assure that affordable housing options are a part of Portland's infrastructure. Crucial details of the set-aside have yet to be resolved, most particularly the percentage of funds to be dedicated to affordable housing. A community process to determine that percentage is part of the resolution. Affordable Housing Now has been advocating for 30%, which would potentially generate more than $100 million for housing over the next 5 years.
And a new study that has found that Oregonians without health insurance are more likely to go without necessary medical care than residents in nearly any other state. 56% of uninsured Oregonians say they cannot afford a visit to the doctor when they need it. That was the second highest percentage of uninsured people reported to be going without health care in the country, closely following West Virginia. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a private health care research organization, analyzed 2004 government data to make the findings, which were released today in anticipation of Cover the Uninsured Week in May. The event is a national campaign to raise awareness of the problems of the uninsured. U.S. Census figures show that 591,000 Oregonians are without health insurance. And as the percentage of people without health insurance continues to grow, the troublesome trend could arise, experts say. Not getting preventative care can be a costly decision because people won't get the treatment until the condition has worsened, which is often more costly and more damaging to their health. Previous studies indicate unemployment, federal Medicaid cuts, and a shrinking Oregon health plan have contributed to Oregon's high level of uninsured.
A new study shows 41% of people with moderate to middle incomes didn't have health insurance for at least a part of last year. That's up from 28% without coverage in 2001. The Commonwealth Fund study also says more than half of the uninsured adults say they're having problems paying their medical bills or have gone into debt to cover their expenses. The survey of 4,300 adults shows people without insurance are more likely to skip recommended health screenings than those with coverage, and they are less likely to have a regular doctor than people who have health insurance. The Commonwealth Fund is a private healthcare policy foundation. Many people feel that the insurance end of the problem is where the trouble lies, and that what people really need is just plain old health care.
The House is taking up a bill that lays out nearly $1 billion for the new National Intelligence Director's Office and undisclosed billions for costly satellites and other spy programs next year. In the debate today, lawmakers are expected to rail against leaks, call for better intelligence on Iran, and criticize the National Security Agency's warrant wireless surveillance program. Still, House Intelligence Chairman Peter Hoekstra's 2007 Intelligence Authorization Bill, which cleared his panel panel unanimously is likely to be approved. The Michigan Republicans' legislation provides budgeting guidelines for the 16 U.S. spy agencies in the Office of National Intelligence Director John Negroponte. The bill's total dollar figure, even the total number of pages, are classified. Lawmakers were seeking some changes in the 50 pages that have been made public. The bill orders Negroponte to conduct a study on whether it makes sense to revoke the pensions of intelligence officers who leak classified information. But Republican Representative Rick Renzi from Arizona says that media corporations and journalists have improperly profited financially from publishing purported unauthorized disclosures of classified information. The draft calls on the president to use his authority to the fullest extent to take action against those who leak classified information. The language offered no substantive or practical changes to current law. The bill provides nearly $1 billion in the primary account that funds Negroponte's organization, created a year ago to organize the 16 disparate intelligence agencies under one leader.
A federal judge has rebuffed the government's attempt to file a secret declaration, a lawsuit filed in Oregon. The lawsuit challenges the legality of the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance program. This from the Oregonian. U.S. District Judge Gar King said that so far the government, in his view, has not made a case that it cannot furnish public information that would support its position. He gave federal officials until May 12th to provide a better argument, adding that he might still consider looking at the secret filing in the future. King is one of the few judges in the country to challenge government attempts to discuss national security issues out of the presence of opposing attorneys. The lawsuit was filed late February by Al Haramain, an Ashland-based Islamic charity, and two of its attorneys. The suit claims that federal officials illegally intercepted telephone calls between Al Haramain, director, and two attorneys based in Washington, D.C. Government officials have responded by filing secret responses not available to opposing counsel or the public. Judges have generally ruled in favor of the government without explaining why. In the Al Haramain case, lawyers for the charity filed a classified document under seal that they say supports their claim that the government illegally intercepted phone calls.
European Parliament investigators said today that the CIA has conducted more than 1,000 undeclared flights over European territory since 2001 in a clear violation of an international treaty. Lawmakers investigating alleged illegal CIA activities in Europe also said incidences when terror suspects were handed over to U.S. agents did not appear to be isolated, and that the suspects were often transported by the same planes and groups of people. EU lawmakers presented a first preliminary report on their findings, working off data provided by Eurocontrol, the EU's air safety agency, and information gathered during 3 months of hearings and more than 50 hours of testimony by individuals who said they were kidnapped and tortured by U.S. agents. Italian lawmaker Giovanni Fava, who drafted the report, says the data showed that CIA planes made numerous stopovers on European territory that were never declared, violating an international air treaty that requires airlines to declare the route and stopovers for planes with a police mission. He added that the routes for some of these flights seem to be quite suspect. They are rather strange routes for flights to take, and it is hard to imagine that those stopovers were simply for providing fuel.
The conviction of a Lodi, California man on terrorism-related charges yesterday is a much-needed victory for the Justice Department, which has fallen all over itself in its pursuit of terrorism suspects in the courts recently. Since 9/11, federal prosecutors have won verdicts against, among others, an Ohio truck driver accused of plotting to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge and a man who threatened to kill President Bush. But there have also been a series of missteps and false starts. The government has seen juries starting to reject charges in some high-profile cases. In one instance, a judge threw out terrorism charges because of alleged misconduct by a federal prosecutor who was later indicted. Yesterday's guilty verdict against 23-year-old Hamid Hayat was a dubious victory in the dubious war on terror. Hamid had been charged in connection with attending a terrorist camp in Pakistan in 2003 and then lying about his attendance to the FBI. A separate jury deadlocked on charges that his father lied to the authorities about his son's participation at the camp, and a mistrial was declared. Hyatt was charged under a federal law that makes it a crime to provide material support to terrorists.
Tony Snow will be named new White House press secretary today, according to Fox News. Snow is expected to be at the White House for the announcement. He has been mulling the offer for the last several days. Long before the announcement, oddsmakers were counting on Snow, host of Fox News Talk's The Tony Snow Show, to be tapped for the highly visible White House post. Sources said Snow was Bush's first choice, but he needed the all-clear from his doctors before he takes the job. Snow is recovering from colon cancer. Fox is considered by some to be the unofficial mouthpiece of the Bush administration. The media conglomerate played a significant role in the last two presidential elections.
Five people whose homes were flooded during Hurricane Katrina are suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers today. The five are accusing the agency of ignoring repeated warnings that a navigation channel it built would turn into a hurricane highway. The lawsuit was filed in federal court in New Orleans, and several prominent trial lawyers from Louisiana, Florida, and California are backing it. At issue is a 76-mile shipping channel built in the early 1960s as a shortcut to New Orleans. For years, environmentalists and others have blasted the Mississippi River Gulf outlet because it has eroded enormous tracts of wetlands and increased the threat of flooding. The suit claims that if the agency had acted on warnings that the channel could cause severe flooding, it would have designed it differently and Katrina would have been an endurable event in New Orleans history. The plaintiffs are seeking compensation for themselves, but also want Congress to set up a Katrina Victims Compensation Fund, similar to that set up for families of the victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks. This from the BBC.
A tiny Portland high-tech company is hoping to get a heck of a job from Brownie. On-Screen Technologies, a maker of compact displays for emergency first responders, has hired Michael Brown, former director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to generate sales to government agencies. Brown is best known for doing a heck of a job on the hapless citizens of New Orleans. Within days of Bush's words of congratulation, Brown was demoted and he soon resigned. But for the next 2 years, at least, he'll be on the inside the beltway face of On-Screen Technologies. He will possibly bring up the startup a shower of government contracts or perhaps a gale of ill will. For its part, On-Screen said it has landed a high-profile, well-connected, and, it says, well-respected leader of the emergency management field, which makes up its core business. This is from the Oregonian.
There are a few things to remember when you say Latin America. The term Latin or Latino emphasizes the influence of the conquering Spanish, particularly ignoring the reality of indigenous people who don't identify as Latino. Mexico is part of North America, and many people south of the U.S. border object to the term American when applied only to people from the United States, because all 880,000 of us are Americans. KBOO's Patrick Angstrom Poor has been traveling through parts of so-called Latin America since October of 2005. For the last several months, he's been living in Petare, one of South America's densest barrios. He brings us part one of a four-part series on life in Venezuela under the leadership of Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution.
Community media is flowering right now in Venezuela. In Caracas alone, there are at least 10 community radio stations, some licensed and some not. One community television station, Katia TV, has ample studios and a well-developed training program that brings dozens of new volunteers in each month. Most community media has existed legally for about 5 years when the Chavez government began actively promoting the creation of community media as a way to empower communities and counterbalance the heavily anti-government programming of commercial media. Ana Viloria works for the Office of Alternative and Community Media in Venezuela's Ministry of Information.
For us, the experience has been that it's possible to counteract the media campaigns of the big media outlets with alternative media, and this happens at the community level, at the national level, and international, with the Alliance of International Networks of Alternative Communication, organizations for the defense of human rights, environmental groups, etc. All the causes that we say are justice-oriented and united to explain what is really going on. It's a policy of the state, the idea that each medium arises from a social organization, and further, each social organization have communication tools, whether it be a newspaper, community television, radio, web page. This is part of the work we do. Another part is to support and accompany groups through the process of creating their own media, and where there are none, stimulate their creation. At this moment, we have, according to the website of Conatel, 191 licensed radio stations transmitting and 352 requests pending for the creation of new community radios.
In Venezuela, the support of the government for community media has resulted in more concrete definitions of the types of alternative media than we use in the United States. Alternative media is any kind of media which is not profit-driven. Community media is very specifically defined. They must have a relationship to a community group and must provide access to that entire community. Such media are eligible for help from the government in the way of equipment and workshops. A radio station that operates without a cooperative is considered alternative, but not community. And media that pertain to a religious organization or political party are considered propaganda and are not eligible for state support. One community station in Caracas, under the management of Carlos Lugo, has been consistently testing dynamic ideas about how to better reach its community. Radio Negro Primero has only a couple of years under its belt, but with 40 or so volunteers, has been extending its influence and reputation. Fernando Barrett, the news director at Radio Negro Primero, describes a couple of their more successful ideas.
Tenemos unos transmisores inalámbricos.
We have wireless transmitters that go into various places in our neighborhood with the director of the radio, equipment, and an assistant. And they plant themselves in these places, talk with the people, talk with the children in the school, in the health centers, talking with the personnel and the patients, going out live on the radio. This produces a strong impact on the people and has the consequence that the people start calling us and the people receive us more enthusiastically each time.
There is a noteworthy difference between low-power radio in the U.S. and in dense South American cities like Caracas. Distinct neighborhoods, called parroquias here, are packed with lots of people in a very small area, often isolated from other areas by sizable hills. This means a small transmitter can reach the entire population of a distinct zone without causing interference with other stations. The people in these zones know each other, they shop at the same stores, and often have lived in the area for generations. That makes community radio a very accessible and appropriate tool for community organizing within a barrio. Contrast this with the United States, where our neighborhoods are often sprawling, impersonal residential areas that have very little civic energy to harness. Conatel, Venezuela's version of the FCC, says that each parroquia can have one and only one community radio. But that still means a city like Caracas can have more than 20 community radio stations, each reflecting the flavor of its own neighborhood. International media producers and opposition groups within Venezuela often criticize the Chavez government for being harsh on free speech. Government policies like the law of social responsibility are given as evidence that the government practices censorship. But it only takes a few minutes of watching commercial media to know that there's a wide latitude to criticize the government here. And in a country with an aggressive policy of developing non-governmental community media, Venezuela is leading the way in democratizing freedom of expression. For KBOO News, I'm Patrick Engstrom-Poor from Caracas, Venezuela.
And the U.S. ambassador in Iraq is urging war-weary Americans to dig in for the long haul. A years-long effort to transform Iraq and the surrounding region, now one of the world's most major trouble spots, is from the L.A. Times. Zalmay Khalilzad, an Afghan immigrant to the U.S. who has for years advocated an aggressive effort to bring democracy to the Muslim world. Now Khalilzad is predicting the long-term American effort to shape the future of this region will continue regardless of which party controls the White House, how many troops remain in Iraq, and what tactics the strategies are employed. Jawad Maliki, endorsed by Iraq's new Council of Representatives as Prime Minister over this weekend, has 30 days to build a government and is negotiating with other blocs to dole out ministerial posts. Khalilzad said Iraq's designated Prime Minister, Jawad Maliki, supports the American-backed version of vision for creating an Iraqi government that can stem the violence. Khalilzad also said Maliki would ease up on policies of de-Ba'athification, which many Sunnis perceive as cover for purging them from the government.
In Iraq, hundreds of Shiite Muslim militiamen have deployed in recent weeks to Kirkuk. The city is widely considered the most likely flashpoint for an Iraqi civil war. The militiamen are vowing to fight any attempt to shift control over Kirkuk to the Kurdish-governed north, this according to the Washington Post. Until recently, the presence of the militias here was minimal. They've been blamed for hundreds of killings during violence in central and southern Iraq because of the bombing of a revered Shiite shrine last February. Kirkuk is Iraq's third largest city with about 1 million residents and sizable ethnic Kurdish, Arab, and Turkmen communities. and a lot of oil.
According to the Kuwaiti news agency, Chief of the Turkish General Staff, Hilmi Ozak, said Turkey will conduct military action in northern Iraq if needed. Ozak said since Article 51 of the UN Charter allows beyond-the-border military action, Turkey might enter Iraq to eliminate Kurdish separatists. While explaining that each nation makes decisions independently, depending on its needs, he said this issue has no link with the visit of U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to Ankara yesterday. Rice flew directly from Turkey to Iraq to join up with Donald Rumsfeld today in a surprise visit to the war-ravaged country to show support for the new government. Ozkak explained that moving the land forces command to the Turkish border has no special connotation, adding that it was only a matter of needing the command over there.
According to Agence France-Presse, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is saying that the United States must persevere in Iraq and Afghanistan to contain, quote, the extreme impulses that we see emanating from Iran, unquote. Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are in Baghdad today. So you come here often. Rumsfeld linked the costly and unpopular U.S. efforts to stabilize Iraq and Afghanistan to U.S. concerns about Iran's nuclear program and its regional might. He said those who believe that U.S. efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan are too costly or are taking too long need to understand that, quote, success in Afghanistan and success in Iraq is critical to containing the extreme impulses that we see emanating from Iran, unquote. His comments came amid a sharpening diplomatic confrontation over Iran's nuclear program, which Washington insists is aimed at developing atomic weapons. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad earlier refused calls for a halt to its uranium enrichment program and warned Iran could withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States, meanwhile, said that the UN Security Council would consider a draft resolution that would oblige Iran to comply or face possible military action.
According to a poll at ArmyTimes.com, a majority of respondents believe that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld should resign. This from Ross Story. In a poll taken shortly after reports of prison abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison came out in 2004, a plurality of readers agreed that Rumsfeld and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Richard Myers shouldn't keep their jobs in light of the allegations. At the time, nearly 45% thought they both should go.
A no-bid Halliburton project in Iraq could cause nightmares for President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. The failed project received front-page treatment in yesterday's New York Times. The article begins by describing an army inspector's view of a gargantuan trench, which was supposed to be a glimmering achievement of the U.S. rebuilding of Iraq's oil infrastructure. The project, called the Fatah Pipeline Crossing, had been a critical element of a $2.4 billion no-bid reconstruction contract that a Halliburton subsidiary had won from the Army in 2003. The spot where about 15 pipelines crossed the Tigris had been the main link between Iraq's rich northern oil fields and the export terminals and refineries that could generate much-needed gasoline, heating fuel, and revenue for Iraqis. For all those reasons, the project's demise would seriously damage the American-led effort to restore Iraq's oil system and enable the country to pay for its own reconstruction. Exactly what portion of Iraq's lost oil revenue can be attributed to one failed project is impossible to calculate, although the failures of that effort are routinely attributed to insurgent attacks. An examination of this project shows that troubled decision-making and execution have played equally important roles.
The media will be barred from the airfield when the plane carrying the remains of four Canadian soldiers killed in Afghanistan lands at Canadian Forces Base Trenton in Ontario, this according to Canadian Press Service. In the past, media have been invited to cover the arrival of the remains of soldiers who have fallen overseas. Military sources would not say why the decision was made, but that a news release was to be issued by the Department of National Defense Monday evening. Department of Defense officials could not immediately be reached for comment.
Jewish leaders and Middle East analysts warned this week that Bush is risking a backlash that could injure the Jewish community and his own plans by repeatedly citing Israel as his top rationale for possible U.S. military conflict with Iran. This from the Jewish Weekly. The analysts and leaders expressed that Bush's repeated, sometimes exclusive focus on Israel could spark public fury against the Jewish state and Jews if U.S. military action is accompanied by skyrocketing gas prices, terrorism at home, or dead soldiers who might be seen as dying for Israel. Others feared it could make it tougher for Bush to recruit countries to oppose Iran's nuclear program by framing the threat as primarily to Israel rather than the international stability. Ambassador Edward Walker, a former U.S. envoy to Israel who now heads the Middle East Institute in Washington, called Bush's Israel focus a terrible idea. Malcolm Hohenlein, Executive Vice President of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, said, quote, "The linkage to Israel is not a good idea," unquote. In recent days, there have been reports of extensive U.S. military planning, possibly for a bombing campaign against a variety of Iranian targets. When asked why Bush has made Israel a focus, Walker added, "Because he is not very attuned to the history of the situation, and he has some really strange advisors who do not understand and the broader implications of this in terms of the vast majority of the American public," unquote.
In Egypt, two suicide bombers struck just outside a multinational peacekeeping forces base in the Sinai near the Gaza border today, and a separate blast hit a police checkpoint in the Nile Delta in the north of the country. The string of explosions rattled Egypt just 2 days after terrorists exploded three bombs at a Sinai beach resort, killing 24 people, mostly Egyptians. Security officials said the suicide attackers died in the strike on the peacekeeping base, and there were conflicting reports on the wounded. The peacekeeping force was set up as part of the 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt that led to Israel's withdrawal from the Sinai. It is partially paid for by the United States and has U.S. advisors and soldiers attached to it, as well as soldiers from several other nations.
As Chinese President Hu Jintao continues his week-long tour of Africa, he has secured four oil drilling licenses from Nigeria, his second in 3 years. This from the BBC. In exchange, China will invest $4 billion in oil and infrastructure projects in Nigeria. China will buy a controlling stake in Nigeria's 110,000-barrel-a-day Kaduna oil refinery and build a railroad system and power stations. Nigeria will offer first right of refusal to China National Petroleum for a quartet of exploration blocks during a licensing round due to be held in Nigeria on May 19th. The blocks comprise two areas in the oil-producing Niger Delta, one onshore and one in shallow water, and two areas in a higher-risk inland Chad Basin where no oil is produced at present. Last week, China state oil firm CNOOC said that it had completed a deal to buy a stake in a Nigerian oil field. The visit indicates the importance China is attaching to securing energy and trade deals in the region. Nigeria has the oil and gas that China wants, but also provides a potential market for Chinese goods. Several Chinese companies have already constructed factories in Nigeria, and more are planned for a free trade zone in the southeast of the country. The visit comes in the wake of a series of others to Africa by Chinese ministers and officials. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, April 26, 2006. Weather for today calls for partly cloudy, highs in the mid-60s. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer, par excellence, is Boone Revis. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Stay tuned.